Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. It feels like old home week to be here. What I've done in the past when I've come to chapel, and I'm honored to be able to do this again, is I start by wanting to thank you. Because I think I'm very fortunate to be out on the campuses talking with lots of art students and students in general in our chapters, and I want to always tell you some story about what your work is doing to bless those students. So I'll start with a quick story, and this will be more like a link. I'm being a link right now, because Christina's already written about this, and Shelley and Jeff are going to put something in Student Soul about what I'm going to tell you. It's a fabulous story that started with a student, a visual arts student at Western Michigan University named Betty, who attended Urbana in St. Louis. And God just put on her heart, big time, that she should do something about the AIDS orphans in Africa. And her response was very logical. What can I do? I'm just, she's now a senior in college, I'm just a student, and I'm just an artist. What can I do to benefit AIDS orphans? And so all of you who worked on Urbana know that you blessed this young lady, and through her, a lot of other people, because starting at the beginning of her last term, that was only several months ago at Western Michigan University, it came back to her, really in a bothersome way, do an art exhibit where you would sell some of the pictures and take the profits from the sale of this art show and send it to Africa. And she said, God, I can't do that. It's way too big for me. And so she said, this is your project, God. You're bothering me with this. If it's going to happen, it has to be you. And so I was there last Thursday and Friday, and a week ago, Friday, 10 days ago, she did the opening of this exhibit. And she went to students, her colleagues at Western Michigan, and she went to faculty and explained that this was about social justice. And 40 people signed up to create works of art that were sold in this exhibit. And some of the faculty people actually assigned students, you have to do this. And none of them were Christians. Well, a couple, but mostly non-Christians. And they were involved in doing something about social justice and this horrible AIDS epidemic. And yet, when people would ask her, now Betty, why are you doing this? She'd tell them. She'd tell them that she was a Christian, and that she felt called to do this, and it was part of her job. It was wonderful. I think they raised something like $1,500, and it was a spectacular exhibition. 500 people came, and there was all sorts of music there as well, and some dramatic sketches that were done by people, and it was a happening. And here's where more payoff comes. Dave Biskey is the staff person who works as an art specialist at Western Michigan. He has already started a group of these non-Christian artists. And I was there for the first meeting last Friday, and there's going to be another meeting 2 days from now. And a whole bunch of people got together to talk about, okay, what is this business about me being an artist that can make a difference in the world, that can change the world for good? And by the way, what's this spirituality stuff that Betty's always talking about? And so we had our first meeting last Friday, and we had a wonderful discussion. It was supposed to be 2 hours long. It went for 4 hours, and then people went out for coffee after that to talk. And again, these are theater people, visual arts people, most of them not Christians, but really being bothered by God about what am I called to do with my life and my gifts. So I want you to know the good stories. I was so blessed to be there and see this begin, and you folks are all a part of that. So thank you. The other thing I do, and I've been very honored to speak at chapel before, is to just share a little bit of what I do with students when I'm out talking to all these wonderful arts people that I work with. And so we'll do that today. And officially, what I want to talk to you about is the power of pictures. How can God speak to us through our eyes? And the other thing is the power of narrative. How does God speak to us through stories? And both of these are arts things, of course. And is it okay if we do discussion format? I'm not a big preacher type, and I love to discuss. So let me start with a question. I would guess that a lot of you are readers, and you love fiction novels, and I bet a lot of you like going to films. So why do you do that? Why do you read fiction? Why do you go to film? Why don't you just go in groups of twos just for a minute and talk with the neighbor next to you? Why do you do that? Oh, of course, there's an element of I want information, but I'm thinking more than that obvious thing. Why would you go to a film? What do you get out of it? Go ahead and talk in small groups for a minute, and then we'll come back together. Let's come back together, everybody, please. The only problem with starting a discussion like this with a group like you is it's hard to cut off the discussion. Okay, a couple people. Just give me real short reasons why you would go to a film or why you'd read a piece of fiction. Anybody?
To another world.
You go into another world. Good, somebody else. There are no right or wrong answers, but why would you do that?
You get to be somebody else.
You get to be somebody else. Others?
Jeff? Gratuitous violence is sometimes very
dreadful. Oh, don't listen to him. If you didn't hear that, that's just as well. Okay, somebody else. Why do you read a novel, or why do you go to a film?
I'm a high possibilities person, and I love fiction where it gives me a different setting to try a worldview or some story.
And so you're wondering what happens next.
Yeah.
How does this work out? Yeah, that's very exciting, that tension of if you get all these ideas assembled and then what happens at the end of the story. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just want to use this as a way to introduce what I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to talk just a tiny bit, and then I'd like to do just a really brief Bible study together. It's a story that you all know well, but before we do that, let me just analyze a little bit of what may be happening when you say, yes, I love fiction, I love going to films, and for the various reasons that you describe. What's going on in that process? And this is what I talk to my art students about all the time, and it's very much what I hope gets transferred into our chapter meetings and our small group Bible studies and discussions, where we actually understand the principles of communication that are going on here. So the first principle is about the power of pictures. And Lisa said very well, and I do the same thing, when I'm involved in something, I often see it in my mind's eye. And it's interesting that we see with our eyes, but we store a tremendous amount of data in pictures up here. And we can go there in our imaginations. And it's a good thing. God gave it to us. Now, I've done some bad things with my imagination, and I'm not proud of that. But on the other hand, if God gave us the gift to think into the future, think into things that have never really happened, and to explore that, and of course, remember the past, and that's a gift that I believe God uses very well. And by the way, just so you know, I have a friend that's looked at this and said, in the Bible, if you analyze it, something like 75% of the Bible is stories, and another 15% of the Bible is poetry, and then 10% is just really didactic teaching. Now, of course, all of that is about teaching. The whole Bible is about us learning about God. But somehow God likes stories. And God likes poetry, and God likes us creating images in our mind that show us something about Him, and ultimately something about our own lives. That there's a process going on here that's very valuable, and we shouldn't ignore. So, okay, about pictures. There was a graduate student in communications who was part of an arts group that met in my house, and this is quite a few years ago, and her name was Lee, and she was telling us how she had just participated in a communications survey about how we take in data. And she said it was very interesting. Between 54 and 57% of the people who responded said that 54 or 57% of the data that came to them came through their eyes, and only 4 to 6% came from words. And I said, oh, well, that makes sense. We're such a visual society, and especially the younger generation, the postmodern folks, are extremely visual in the way they think and process. But the part that surprised me was that only 4 to 6% came from words, because it bothered me. What do we do in church most of the time? Use words. And are we missing out on something that God has given us, is the question that popped up to me right away. And thank goodness we in InterVarsity have 2100 and all the great things that they've produced for all these years using images as well as words. But I've heard other people say it's much higher than 57%, that what comes to us through our eyes is more like 80 or 90% of what we input. And so I tied that up with the word imagination, and you know that the beginning of imagination is the word image, and I realized, oh my gosh, this stuff of us thinking through our eyes is perhaps much more important than we've realized in the past. And just as a little example, think of somebody you love, somebody that loves you. Just think of them right now. Every single one of you is seeing a face, right? And later comes the name. I see my daughter's face, and then I say, oh, it's Christina. We all do that. We store a tremendous amount of data in pictures. Well, that's important. And here's the second part. Narrative, stories, why are they so powerful? I think all of you said it right away. Somehow or other, if a story is good, and by the way, Jesus was a fabulous storyteller, if the story is good, somehow we go live in that story. Now, I don't know how that works. I've talked to professional educators about it, and they shake their heads, and they agree. It's a very powerful thing. But they don't know how it happens either in terms of figuring out what goes on in our minds and our hearts. But we live there for a little bit. How many of you saw the movie Saving Private Ryan 10 years ago? Oh, the most violent anti-war movie I've ever seen. It's a fabulous movie. And for the first 20 minutes, Steven Spielberg has us on the beachhead at Normandy in France when the American soldiers are landing and being massacred. And it's horrible. It's just horrible. The sounds of the bombs going off and the sights of men being mowed down and blown up in the air by mortar shells and the randomness of the killing, two people standing side by side and one falls over dead. Yes, this is the violence that you said can be beneficial. He's back there with this big grin on his face. Okay, you're right. Sometimes. And you know, when I saw that movie, I just hated it. I was sitting on a cushy seat in a theater, and people all around me were clutching their popcorn, but I tell you, nobody was eating their popcorn because it was so terrible. And I felt like I was on that beachhead, and I wanted it to end, and I wanted to get off there, and I wanted to stop seeing this. And there was no question, I was living for a moment in that film. And it just did a lot for my long-term understanding of how horrible war is. And actually, I went back to see it a week later and took my son with me, so he could see this is what war is really like. This is the amazing thing about narrative. Why? Because it's experiential learning. When we experience something, when we really feel we're part of what's going on, that's the take home. That's what we can remember for months, or even like I'm telling you about that movie and I saw it 10 years ago, it's still very vivid in my mind, and a lot of it is picture. So there's a tie-in between the power of pictures and the power of stories. Making sense? Let's do a quick Bible study. I don't want to talk too much. I want to go to what was put on your chair. And I think we can do this fairly quickly because you all know this story. Just read the top, the John 8, would you please? Just read it to yourself. I feel a little bit like I'm preaching to the choir here because I bet you at least a third of you have preached about this text or led Bible studies about it in the past. So I'm not speaking down to you. What I'm doing here is modeling some of the stuff we do in training our student leaders about Bible studies and how to arrange large groups where there's a lot of retention, where people have experiential learning happening. So you know the context. Just before this, Jesus is going around in Jerusalem saying, I am living water. Mercy, forgiveness can come from me. You don't have to go to the temple anymore and sacrifice animal sacrifices. And of course, it made the Pharisees furious. So they actually sent out soldiers to try to arrest him, and they couldn't. They couldn't put their hands on him for some wonderful reason. Now, I'm going to ask you to imagine what it was like if you were a bystander. Maybe you're one of the disciples saying, oh no, Jesus, you're in trouble again. We've got to get out of here. Or maybe you're a bystander. Maybe you're somebody on the way to the market and you happen to walk by the temple in Jerusalem and you saw this happening. And imagine this story as if you didn't know the end. You didn't know about Good Friday. You didn't know about Easter. You didn't know about the whole rest of the book. And humor me here, but some of you may want to close your eyes and just in your mind picture what might have looked like to actually be there. I'll just read it to you a little bit slowly. Everybody else went home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Amazing story. And it's true. Okay, groups of twos again. What surprises you in this? What jumps out at you? Again, don't worry about the end of the story. If you just happened to be there when this was actually going on, what surprises you? What questions do you have about what's going on? And there are a ton of them. So talk in groups of twos. Let's come back together, everybody. Oh, it kills me to cut off this discussion. It also kills me not to know what's going on in each discussion. A couple people, what were the questions you had or the observations? This is just about OIA, right? This is just about observation. What are some of the things that jump out at you? Anybody?
Why wasn't the man brought to?
Oh! Bingo! Jim says, "Where's the man?" If she was caught in adultery, I don't think she was doing it by herself. So where's the man? They were supposed to be stoned together. Any other questions? That's a biggie. Somebody else, what do you notice? What surprises you?
What did Jesus write yet?
Yeah, what was that business about? Kneeling down, that's not a very kingly posture, and he's writing in the dirt with his finger? Whoa.
Well, then assuming that he's bending down writing silently in the dirt,
mm-hmm.
It says those who heard began to go. What did they hear? And who did they hear it from?
Very good observation. He said those without sin throw the first stone, and then what happened? There's kind of a gap there. When God did something in the hearts of those Pharisees and the stone holders, yeah. Oh, we could go on for a half hour on just this, because you're very intelligent people and probably as interested in the ramifications of this as anybody could be. Do you have something, Scott?
But John seems pleased to throw mysteries out that he doesn't explain why the oldest left first and what he's writing. All these things, he seems happy to leave, to purposefully plant questions and then to not address them.
Yes. And why did God give us our imaginations? Because I think as we put ourselves in the scene, there's instant personal application that starts to happen. Let me ask you two different questions that follow right up on that, Scott. How old do you think this woman was? How old and why? Now, if Jesus wants us to know an exact age, like with the daughter of Jairus, we were told she was 12 years old. And there's a reason why that came out in the Gospels. But now in this instance, there's no age given. So how old do you think she might be? And we get to pick an age. Whether it's right or wrong doesn't really matter, because this is one of these gaps that John leaves open for us to fill in, and maybe God will meet us in that filling in process. And here's another question. What was she wearing? Okay, talk in groups of twos. Okay, I hate to cut you off, but let's share a little bit. How old do you think she might be? And you get to pick. No right or wrong answers. How old do you think she might be? 20s? Lifespan was more 30 to 35 for women in those years. So end of lifespan, you're saying. Older woman for that era. Why would you choose that, Christine?
Well, I thought because in that culture, it just popped in my mind to begin with. But then as I thought about it, I thought, you know, in that culture, younger women actually had the system worked for them. They either had their parents to live with or they lived with their husband's household. So once they became a widow, their parents were dead. Then
so she might be...
What were they to do?
You know, do you think she might have been working lady? She might have been on the streets?
Shirley brought up a really good point in our discussion. She said, well, wouldn't she be the one that was married? And I said, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I just assumed that it was the man that was married. And
hey.
We won't go there. Interesting thought.
I wasn't trying to accuse anyone. I just that was my assumption as I read the story, that she was single and perhaps doing this because she needed to make money or something like that. But...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what we're doing here is two things. We're beginning to put a face on this person, because if we just think of her as kind of an object, oh, there was a woman, no face. But by talking about age, I've had a lot of students really become very personal about this, and they start thinking about their younger sister or people they room with in the dorms, and they begin to say, oh my gosh, we've all done things that are wrong. This poor girl, what if she's 12? Because that was marriageable age. And what if she was forced into a marriage with some old guy that was really mean to her? And she had someone that she loved. I mean, you see how the personal application happens right away and people begin to put faces on it. Tell me about what was she wearing?
I never thought about what she was wearing. I just pictured her in a normal garb. But if she's caught in the act of adultery, heaven knows it.
Yeah. I doubt if they gave her a chance to doll up before they hauled her off to the stoning. See what we're doing through pictures here? I mean, all you guys get this. I know you get it. Again, I'm preaching to the choir. But you see how, as soon as we try to attach a picture, all at once our imaginations start to evolve. And it's okay that we all have different pictures. God gave us these imaginations for a good reason. Because again, I say, this is often a key to the personal application. Yeah, it's a startling thing to see the students say, oh my gosh, the humiliation. She was dragged through the streets, maybe just wearing a sheet. She grabbed anything to cover herself. And imagine the humiliation, and imagine what if her parents saw her. Oh my gosh, horrible.
Does the question ever come up, how did the Pharisees catch her in the act of adultery?
Bingo! There's something that smells about this story. Was there an early morning Pharisee peeping Tom patrol out looking for people through bedroom windows? I don't know, but something...
Might have been connected with the fact that the guy wasn't there.
Something smells about this story. There's one way that we always have to finish every Bible study, and that is we always have to say, what are we learning about God? And then what are we learning about ourselves? And there's great excitement when we start to get into this kind of experiential stuff, when we start to see it in our own mind's eye and we somehow participate. By the way, discussion is experiential learning. Anytime we are actively not just listening but talking, that's part of the experiential learning. So what have we learned about God? What have we learned about ourselves? A question I often ask students is, with whom do you identify in this story? And usually to prompt the honesty level, I say that I unfortunately have to say that there are times when I identify with the Pharisees, that I'm extremely judgmental, and I hope that God helps me fight against that. But with whom do we identify? Are there things in our own lives where we know we should be stoned, but amazingly Jesus says something different? So my prayer is this. Lord, thank you for InterVarsity. Thank you for all these people in this room who labor so hard to create the student leaders of the future for our campuses, to touch our faculty, but also the leaders who will go out into the world and make culture that is good and right, and take you with them when they work for NBC television or when they work in the film industry or in the print media business. Lord, continue the good work you're doing. And Lord, let us every day have experiential learning about your personal love for each of us. Holy Spirit, come.